A fine instrumental there from George Harmonica Smith, entitled The Ecstatic Stomp. That's from a Blind Pig record called Now You Can Talk About Me. And we heard from Carrie Bell and his blues harp, and you know that ain't right. All right, up next here on the Deep Blues Hour, let's hear from Charlie Musselwhite from his release Blues Never Die, put out through Vanguard Records. This is After a While, Charlie Musselwhite on the Deep Blues Hour.
Protect his home and family from disaster. Steve used courage, wisdom, and his camera phone.
That should do it.
Way to go, Steve! By simply taking digital pictures of his family's important documents, Steve can always have them stored safely online, no matter when disaster strikes. Learn other simple ways to protect your home and family before a natural disaster at ready.gov. That's ready.gov. A message from FEMA and the Ad Council.
Put me down, brought you from the country, I brought you to town. Don't be a fool, woman, don't be a fool, fool and lose what you got. You didn't have shoes on your feet. Didn't have bread in your house to eat. Don't be a fool, woman. Don't be a fool, fool, and lose what you got. I bought you a house, a car to drive. When I want some loving, you say you're tired. Don't be a fool, woman. Don't be a fool, fool, and lose what you got. Talked about me to the neighborhood. Said I was too old, was no doggone good. Don't be a fool, woman. Don't be a fool, fool, and lose what you got.
Welcome to the David Pakman Show. I'm Farron Cousins from Ring of Fire, sitting in for David Pakman again today. But don't worry, folks. David will return on Monday with fresh content for you. I did, in fact, confirm that with him today. So he will be back. And I thank you all for watching this week as I've been filling in. It is a great honor, a great opportunity. Thank you to David. Thank you to Pat. Thank you to everybody with this show. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing to be able to do. And the audience, y'all are absolutely fantastic as well. And because of that, I'm giving you a special treat today. I am actually kicking off this show with an entire segment filled with good, positive news. Now, as we all know, in this, I guess, profession, if you want to call it that, we don't get to talk about good things very often. Usually it's how things have gone wrong, how things could go wrong, the craziness coming from our politicians, but, and of course we have all of that coming up later, but for right now, folks, good news. And the first piece of good news is that the FDA has authorized the very first COVID treatment pill from Pfizer that they're predicting will be available in a matter of days. And this comes, as we talked yesterday, as Omicron has now overtaken, become the predominant strain of COVID here in the United States. More than 73% of new cases are Omicron. And of course, the graphs are going back up. We're seeing another upward curve. So getting this treatment, having this finally be available for the first time, is a huge positive development in our handling of the pandemic. Because let's be honest, we know that the vaccines are effective. We know that the vaccines have been preventing people from getting serious illness, have been preventing lots and lots of deaths, but it's not enough because not enough people are getting it. That's how we end up with more mutations and more different variants, and of course, the increasing deaths and number of cases. Having this treatment gives us really this two-pronged attack against the virus itself. Now, this treatment, the pill called Paxlovid, again, produced by Pfizer, the administration has already pledged more than $5 billion to purchase about 10 million doses from Pfizer over the course of the next year. 10 million doses is not very much. I mean, when we're talking about the grand scope of COVID here in the United States, 10 million isn't going to get us very far. Pfizer says, however, they're hoping to be able to produce between 80 and 120 million doses within the next 12 months. So that's good. That might be enough. So what we know so far is in the early days, much like with the vaccines, the priority for these COVID pills is going to go to the elderly, those 65 and older, and those with high-risk comorbidities, chronic lung problems, asthma, diabetes, heart problems. So again, that's very similar to what we saw in the early days of the vaccine rollout. And then hopefully, once that is kind of under control, once we get more production going, it will be widely available to anyone who comes down with COVID. And Pfizer also tells us another bit of good news. They have every reason to believe that this treatment will also be effective against the Omicron variant, which obviously wasn't a thing when they were doing their testing, but they believe it should be just as effective. And here's why. It all has to do with how the treatment itself works, which here it is. This is from Wall Street Journal. Researchers designed the pill to stop the coronavirus from spreading in people by blocking activity of a key enzyme known as protease, and my apologies if I'm mispronouncing that, which the virus needs to replicate. The enzyme isn't believed to be mutated in Omicron, which is why Pfizer and other researchers say the antiviral likely will work against Omicron. The authorization comes after researchers found Paxlovid was safe and cut the risk of hospitalization or death by about 89% if people at high risk of severe COVID took the pill within 3 days of diagnosis. Treatment was also highly effective if begun within 5 days of symptoms. So what's great about that is it's not one of those treatments where once you show symptoms, oh no, the treatment's not going to work. No. You basically have a timetable of if you can get it within 3 to 5 days of first showing symptoms, this thing has a real chance, you know, 89% chance of reducing the risk of hospitalization or death. So that brings in another part of this, early detection. People have to know if the symptoms they're exhibiting are COVID, or maybe it's a flu, maybe it's a cold, maybe it's something else. So that's where these at-home testing kits come into play. And the administration this week said they're going to give 500 million at-home tests out to the public. You know, free of charge. You don't have to pay for these things. 500 million, we need more. We're going to need more. And they need to not just be available. It's time. Use your power. Send them to people's homes. That's what needs to happen here. Sure, you're going to have some nutty people out there that just throw them out. And we're going to see videos about it online. But the risk is less than the reward. Because people have to get that early detection so they know right away when they get the sniffles, uh-oh, this is COVID. Let me go see if I can get that treatment pill, knock this out, and avoid something far worse from happening to me. So again, hugely positive story. Combined with the vaccines, we may finally be on track to get this pandemic under control, because really, the treatment for it has been the big X factor. So far, up to this point, we haven't had any kind of set treatment. You know, it really has been not the kitchen sink part, but it's been doctors just trying to keep people alive. And that's great. They've done phenomenal work, but we haven't been able to find something to actually stop the virus, from replicating inside of the human body until this treatment. So this is good news. This is highly positive. Hopefully Pfizer can ramp up their production, which is what they're hoping to be able to do, to get more and more doses out there. And if this works, and of course, if we can get this spread around the globe so that everybody has access to the treatment, not just us here, if we can do that, we may finally get this pandemic not just under control, but maybe even eradicated in the future. Second piece of hugely positive news, and I'm not, you know what, before I even get into this, let me go ahead and say, because this is positive news. All over social media, people are glad about it, but saying, go further, and I'm going to talk about that. But the piece of positive news that I want to talk about now is that the Biden administration announced on Wednesday they were going to extend the student loan debt repayment deadline. Meaning, instead of payments resuming on February 1st, they are now set to resume on May 1st. They have kicked it back 90 days, giving people more time, I guess, to make adjustments, whatever it is. Those 3 months mean the world to people suffering under the burden of student loan debt. And this wouldn't have happened, and this is really the positive part of this story, this wouldn't have happened without the push from the public for the administration to do this. That's the real positive part of this story, that the activism worked, much like actually with the COVID tests. Yet a week and a half ago, Jen Psaki kind of laughed it off during a press conference of, what, are we supposed to send a test to everybody? You know, give it to them for free? And then after pushback, they're like, okay, we are going to do that. Same thing with this student loan repayment. People have been pushing them, warning them. Even economists have been warning them. You're about to deal a major blow to the economy, taking out roughly $85 billion from it when these payments restart. Is that where you want to be in an election year? Tanking your own economy, putting hardship on your voters? And the administration says, okay, we're going to kick the can down the road 90 days. So now it comes to the other part of it, right? Cancellation. Full-blown, absolute cancellation. And of course, that is what a lot of people are pushing for. To be honest, that is what I'm pushing for. That is what I want to see happen in this country. That's what needs to happen. Yes, I understand all the arguments on the other side. You took out the loans. You're responsible for repaying them. What do we do next? Pay off your house? Well, yeah. You want to get people into homes? You want to get them off the streets? You want to give them the opportunity for a real chance at a better life? Yeah, you could. You should. So I am all for 100% full-blown student loan debt cancellation. Short of that, I'm in favor of Biden keeping his campaign promise, which is to pay off $10,000 of everybody's loans. He did make that promise. It's still on his Twitter. You can go and see it yourself. He said he would do that. And of course, we can talk about the economic impacts of that, which, you know, some people, that's the only thing that matters. So I went through, compiled these statistics, looked at some old studies from this year, earlier this year. Here's what we have. Right now, as of today, we have $1.57 trillion in student loan debt held by more than 40 million borrowers. The Livy Economic Institute of Bard College used data from 2016, and they found that cancellation of the outstanding student loan debt would translate to an increase of $86 billion to $108 billion on average per year to our gross domestic product here in the United States. Information from just a couple months ago, this is actually from the Federal Reserve, says that those payments are averaging $200 to $300 per month. That's the average. Some people pay less, some people pay more, but that's what we're looking at. So a full cancellation, not just 10,000, although 10,000 would cancel debt for millions of people, you're talking about giving them an extra $200 to $300 per month, which is what they've had during the pandemic. That, for a lot of people, that's like an extra paycheck. And do you know what people do with that money? Well, we know, because the analysis also came out this week, along with the child tax credit. They're using it to pay off other debts. Some people are actually able to put some of it in savings. They're using it to pay medical bills. They're using it to pay housing expenses. They're using it to buy food. They're using it on car repairs, which is something that a lot of people tend to overlook as a major factor. You know, when we talk about those studies that show that people can't afford an emergency of $700 or more, a lot of those emergencies either involve an immediate health crisis or an automobile crisis. Car repairs are not cheap, and the cost of all of those continue to go up each and every year. And that becomes a major factor. That takes away somebody's ability to get to and from work, to take their kids to and from school or daycare or whatever it is. So that is a major problem. So $200 to $300 a month, if we had full student loan debt forgiveness, would absolutely be life-changing for these individuals. And we have seen that since March of 2020, when these payments were first paused. So I applaud the administration for listening to the public and pushing this 90 days back. Personally, I want it all canceled. Economically, it should be all canceled. Zero it out, change people's lives for the better. And of course, the other side of that, that is certainly, would certainly help Democrats politically in the midterms. Look, we got to take a quick break. I'm Farron Cousins, sitting in for David Pakman. You can find me all over social media at Farron Balanced. We'll be right back with more of The David Pakman Show. Welcome back to The David Pakman Show. I am Farron Cousins, in for David Pakman today. You can find me on YouTube at youtube.com/FarronBalanced. You can also find me on the big YouTube channel, youtube.com/TheRingOfFire. And of course, I'm on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Farron Balanced. So we talked about the good news in the first segment today. And that may be all the good news we have, because now it's time to really get into the nitty-gritty, nutty stories of this week. And one of those stories we hit on earlier this week when Donald Trump announced that he was suing New York's Attorney General Letitia James because he believes, or at least his lawyers attempt to argue, that the investigation into him and his company in New York is somehow unconstitutional. Yes, unconstitutional to conduct your constitutional duties as investigators. But that's not it. That's not all that happened. Because after the lawsuit was announced, Donald Trump decided it would be a sound legal strategy to issue a statement and openly attack and mock New York Attorney General Letitia James. Here is what Donald Trump had to say in his statement. And this is a long one, so bear with me. Tell Letitia that she is not dealing with the Cuomo brothers, a corrupt governor in a corrupt state, including your office and others, and Fredo, who did the governor's dirty work for him. Despite many years of investigation that nobody else could have survived, even if they did things just slightly wrong, yours is just a continuation of the political witch hunt that has gone on against me by radical left Democrats for years. This is not about delay. This is about our Constitution. You are nothing but a corrupt official doing the dirty work of your party. You should not be in office. This could well be the reason you were just rejected by the people of New York in your inept run for governor. You didn't quit for a higher purpose. You quit because your poll numbers were atrocious. You didn't have a chance. New York got lucky. Now, I've never been under criminal investigation. I've never been arrested. You know, I've never really been on the wrong side of the law in terms of things like this. So, I don't know, but I'm willing to bet, after working with the best lawyers in this country for more than 17 years, that openly and repeatedly mocking and antagonizing the person doing the investigating, probably not the smartest legal strategy out there. I'm not a lawyer, right? I didn't go to law school, but I'm willing to bet that's probably not what you should do. And I have to imagine that Trump's lawyers were sitting there after this statement came out, just probably in shock, thinking to themselves, oh my God, oh Lord, what is going to happen now? And then of course, probably being happy, like, well, wait a minute, this probably means we get to work a little bit longer and therefore, you know, we'll get paid more money. So, hey, it's a win for us. But, oh my God, this is going to be so difficult to defend now. Like, I can't imagine that these lawyers actually signed off on Trump's attack against the investigator. This is the woman who holds your fate in her hand. You know, I'm willing to bet, based on what we already know from documents that are already publicly available, that she probably has enough information to at least charge you with something right now. Whether it sticks or not is irrelevant, but she could make your life hell by going ahead and filing charges, at least for what's happening up in Westchester, right? We got those docs. We know what you told the city your property was worth, and we know what you reported on your financial disclosure forms as president. Those two numbers could not be more different. So I think she could go ahead and probably pop you for tax fraud right now, you know, just to kind of get the ball rolling. And as I discussed the other day, you know, about this whole political witch hunt thing, one, I think he knows something big is about to happen and he's trying to get ahead of it. He's trying to go ahead and plant the seeds of doubt with his base, with his followers. So that way, when it finally breaks, he can say, see, I told you, total political witch hunt. But the second thing that already disproves the witch hunt theory is that they've found some witches. You know, Weisselberg has been charged. The Trump Organization itself has been charged. Okay, those are very real criminal charges against these two groups. So you can't sit there and try to say that, oh, this is all fake. Nobody listened to it. Nobody pay attention. It's absolutely just out to get me for political purposes. Well, even if that were true, which it's not, the fact that they found crimes would in fact justify their political witch hunt, would it not? But all of this, you know, Trump kind of gave up the game in his statement, like, this isn't about delay. All right, so because of that, we now know this is totally about delay. And I think the delay that he wants to have happen is he wants this investigation, one, to slow down. That's what his lawsuit's about. So that way, after the midterms, assuming Republicans win, actually, it doesn't even matter if Republicans win. But after the midterms, that's when Trump is likely, according to his closest people, to announce that he is, in fact, running for president again in 2024. He doesn't want to make this announcement prior to the midterms because he doesn't want to be blamed if things go sideways for the Republicans. So if the Republicans win, he's going to come out and say, listen, you won because of me, therefore I'm running for president. If they lose, he's going to say, you lost because I wasn't there, therefore I am running for president. Then once he announces he is running for president, he is going to try to use that, oh, you can't prosecute me because I'm a candidate. I've got executive privilege again, even though I'm just a candidate. That's what he's going for. Wait it out as long as possible. Try to delay it with this ridiculous lawsuit he filed. And of course, in the meantime, antagonize the very people who could ultimately end up sending you to prison, which again, poor legal strategy, but it's Trump we're dealing with, so, you know, you can't hope to control him. You can only try to contain him every now and then. And another thing that Trump might need containment for is his recently announced January 6th commemorative press conference that he's going to be holding down in South Florida. This week, Trump did in fact announce that he is going to hold this big press conference, give a big old speech on the anniversary of the January 6th Capitol riot. This is going to be held at Mar-a-Lago. All of the major media outlets will most likely be there, which I happen to think is a big mistake. I think the best way to handle this upcoming speech is to totally ignore it and pretend it doesn't exist. Don't give him the airtime. Absolutely do not make him feel important. That is the best thing the media outlets could do. And the reason they should do this is because we already know what kind of drivel he's going to be spewing at us during this little press conference or whatever it is you want to call it. And we know that because he basically gave us his talking points in his announcement. Here it is. Why isn't the Unselect Committee of highly partisan political hacks investigating the cause of the January 6th protest, which was the rigged presidential election of 2020? I will be having a news conference on January 6th at Mar-a-Lago to discuss all of these points and more. Until then, remember the insurrection took place on November 3rd. It was the completely unarmed protest of the rigged election that took place on January 6th. All right. So we're going to hear some more election lies. Maybe he's got some new ones to throw out there. I don't know. You know, it'd be great to have a remix of the greatest hits instead of him just going out there and playing the same old songs that we all know so well. But the downplaying of the events that took place on January 6th, that's the real problem. And of course, he's doing that, I believe, because he's gearing up for a presidential run and he wants these people back in his corner. And he may have already lost some of them because we have had plenty of reports over the past year. They're mad they didn't get presidential pardons. They're mad he's not helping pay their legal bills. They're mad that he hasn't stuck up for them more over this past year. So this might be his way of trying to atone for that. Although with regards to presidential pardons, you really missed your opportunity on that one, buddy. So I don't know how many of these people are willing to come back to you. I know most of them likely will, but some of them clearly won't. But the danger lies in what he's going to say. Because he's going to, as he tells us here, try to claim that these people were just peaceful protesters. They weren't armed. They didn't deserve any of this. Of course, you can bet we're going to hear stuff about Ashley Babbitt and how she was murdered by police officers and how these bloodthirsty cops just shot her in cold blood. And for the record, I do not think that Ashley Babbitt should have been killed. Absolutely not. Yeah, it doesn't matter who the cops are killing. I'm against it. So I do think that Ashley Babbitt should still be alive today. So too, for the record, should the police officers that were there. Because that's the part these conservatives always like to gloss over. They like to talk about Ashley Babbitt, but we got multiple cops. Where's their concern for them? Where's the Blue Lives Matter crowd on that issue, right? Nowhere to be found. Radio silence from those individuals. And one of the reasons I also believe that Donald Trump is doing this is because he sees the walls closing in over here with that select committee investigation, or as he hilariously called it, the unselect committee. Who? Burn. No, that's childish. I could take that to my 7-year-old, and I promise you he could come back in 5 minutes with 10 better insults for the committee if he wanted to go that route. But the committee is getting closer. The committee is getting closer to Donald Trump. The sentences that we're starting to see handed down for these Capitol rioters are getting longer. They're getting more intense. The judges this past summer were telling prosecutors, you're being too lenient on these individuals. You're letting them off for lesser charges. We can get them on more, and we should, to prove a point. But most importantly, Trump knows that that committee is getting closer to him personally. So, he feels the best path forward for him is to go out there with this press conference that, again, the media should ignore, but they won't. He's going to go out there. He's going to lie about what happened. He's going to downplay it. He's going to attempt to rewrite history a year after we all watched it unfold on our TVs. But he's not doing it to protect the rioters. He's not doing it because he feels any kind of sympathy towards these individuals. He's doing it to make it seem like a lesser offense that his office, at least, was attempting to overturn the results of the 2020 election. And, of course, that's why we're going to get mostly election lies out of him that day. You know, he has kind of been amped up about all of that recently, and it is because his administration is being exposed. We're finding out things because of the Select Committee that we likely would have not otherwise known. We would not have known about the text messages with Mark Meadows. We would not have known about the Fox News host reaching out and panicking, "Oh my God, you got to do something about these people." So all of that combined has culminated in Donald Trump feeling the need to go out there and rewrite history for all of us. And again, not just the history of January 6th, but the history of the 2020 election. We've had the audits, we've had the recounts, we've had the signature verifications. We have gone through every possible step of the process, and the fraud that we have found, almost all of it, rests in the hands of Republican voters. Still, majority of Republicans believe the 2020 election was in fact stolen, so Trump will never give up those talking points, because unfortunately, they've been pretty darn effective with his Republican base. I'm Farron Cousins, and for David Pakman, we'll be right back. Welcome back to the David Pakman Show. I'm Farron Cousins from Ring of Fire, sitting in for David Pakman. But, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, David will, in fact, be back on Monday with fresh content for you. But, for now, let's get right back to it. Of course, one of the biggest things this week was the Turning Point USA conference. And as we all know, one of the featured speakers was Kyle Rittenhouse. And when Rittenhouse emerged onto that stage, it was basically like WWE, right? He had his own theme song that they created for him. So if you haven't already seen the video, brace yourselves, because here is Kyle Rittenhouse's entrance into that Turning Point USA conference. Take a look.
Get loud for Kyle.
The crowd loved him. You heard chanting, "Kyle, Kyle." But there was one person that was not happy about this. There was one conservative who understood that maybe this isn't the best guy to be hoisting upon our collective shoulders. And believe it or not, folks, that person happens to be Fox contributor Tomi Lahren. On an episode of Outnumbered this week, Lahren actually, I can't say she laid into conservatives for idolizing Kyle Rittenhouse, but she did question why they're treating him like a rock star. Here's what she had to say. "I do think that as conservatives, we need to be a little careful when it comes to this. I believe we can put up Kyle Rittenhouse as someone who was innocent and was bullied by and mistreated by the media, but I think we should step back a little. Maybe not treat him like he's a rock star or a celebrity. I don't think that's necessarily a good look for the conservative movement. He did what he had to do. He was defending himself. Let's talk about self-defense. Let's talk about the riots. Let's talk about how everything went horribly, horribly wrong that day. But I think we should take a step back and not make the man Bon Jovi. But that's just my take," she says. Of course, that's how they, oh, but that's just my opinion, you know. Don't kill the messenger. Here's the thing. She's right. That's a weird thing to say, but Tomi Lahren is right. And she's right for several reasons. The first is, what's he done? Well, let's be honest. We all know what happened. Two people are dead. Kyle Rittenhouse was acquitted. Now, we could argue all day long whether or not you think it was self-defense, whether you think he should be here, but those arguments no longer really matter, okay? Kyle Rittenhouse faced a jury. He had his defense. We had the prosecutors. Defense prevailed. Kyle Rittenhouse was acquitted. That's the end of that. So we're not even going to get into that. But two people are dead, and we know that he killed them. The court says it's in self-defense, so we have to accept that. And now he's a hero. Like, now they're lifting him up. Now they gave him a speaking gig. Now, I'll be perfectly honest with you. I don't know what he said. I didn't listen to it. I have no interest in listening to it. I don't care what he has to say. Although we do know that he did say in an interview after the acquittal that, you know, people shouldn't be praising him for this. I guess he's okay with it now. But either way, Lahren's point, I think, I don't want to put words in her mouth, but I think what she's trying to get at is why? What's the longevity of Kyle Rittenhouse? What is he actually doing to further the conservative cause? So the answer to that question would obviously be nothing. Not a thing. And of course, Turning Point is supposed to be about these conservatives who are out there making a difference, pushing their horrible conservative policies on us, spitting out, giving us new conservative talking points. But that's not what Kyle Rittenhouse is. He's not a political operative. I mean, he's a kid. He's a kid that's now gotten swept up into all of this. And honestly, I don't think he understands it either. I don't think he knows where he's going with this. Does he have a future in the conservative movement? Does Kyle Rittenhouse have a shelf life? And that's the big point that Tomi Lahren herself is attempting to make. Think of it this way. I pointed this out actually on Fair and Balanced as well. The McCloskeys, right? The St. Louis gun couple. We all remember them, right? What are they doing now? They were conservative heroes. Heck, they had a speaking spot at the GOP convention last year. Where are they now? Are they still these conservative rising stars? I know the guy was going to run for Senate, and I don't think that went very well for him. I don't even know if that's still happening. Because nobody cares about the McCloskeys anymore. And the same thing will eventually happen to Kyle Rittenhouse. You know, maybe, you know, the gun rights organizations will try to use him as a poster child. Maybe he'll do that. Maybe he won't. That's all pure speculation at this point, to be honest. We don't know what he will or will not do with this newfound fame. But one thing we can pretty much all come to the same conclusion on is that based on others who've been in this situation before, the fame doesn't last. The spotlights fade, they disappear, and people will forget, except the families affected, who this individual is, and they won't care anymore. And I would like to think that that's what Tomi Lahren was getting at. But I also think there could be a degree of jealousy there, right? And let's face it, a couple years ago, Tomi Lahren was the it girl, right? She was the one everybody was clamoring for. She was the one making the headlines. She was the one out there helping craft the direction of the Republican Party. A lot of people forgot she existed. So maybe, and this is, you know, to pull a Lahren, that's just my opinion, maybe she's a little jealous of having to share the spotlight. Maybe she's a little jealous that the spotlight's not on her anymore. You know, people have moved on. And what's funny about that is I actually said that many years ago when she first burst onto the scene. Because I have been in this business for going on 18 years. We have seen them come and go. We have seen the fly-by-nighters. They make a big pop. They make a big splash. They hang around for a bit, sell a couple of books, and then they disappear. they fade off into obscurity because the Republican movement, you know, this conservative media thing, it's always trying to find the next hero, trying to find the next big thing, trying to find the next pretty face in many instances. And Tomi's star is fading. Relegated to a weird show on Fox, having to appear on a midday show to tell people that it's a little cringeworthy what the Republicans are doing with Kyle Rittenhouse. Yeah. Next stop is Hollywood Squares, maybe Dancing with the Stars. And people will have forgotten all about Tomi Lahren at that point. And that's, I think, what really scares her the most. Yes, conservatives should not be hoisting Kyle Rittenhouse upon their shoulders. But Tomi Lahren speaks from experience. She knows what it's like. And she knows how much it hurts when you come crashing down to reality. So the question is, who is the next big star of the Republican Party? Well, there was a phenomenal piece written this week by a good friend of mine, Cliff Schechter, writing for the Daily Beast. The piece is titled, Dan Crenshaw is the Trumpiest of the Wannabe New Trumps. And in the piece, he talks about the fact that, sure, we've got other conservatives out there kind of, you know, hinting at and testing the waters. You got your Nikki Haley's, of course, you got your Ted Cruz. Maybe they're the ones to take up the mantle of Trumpism here in the U.S. And then, of course, you've got the really wackier ones, your Marjorie Taylor Greens and your Boberts and your Gateses. But none of them, Cliff points out, have what Dan Crenshaw has. Dan Crenshaw, for the most part, is not as openly extreme as some of those other individuals. He knows how to speak to an audience. He effectively has, as Cliff points out, what Trump had. That charisma, coupled with, of course, shamelessness and cruelty. But it's the charisma. It's his ability to play to an audience, much like Donald Trump did, that is what makes Crenshaw so dangerous and, of course, most likely the heir apparent to Donald Trump's entire political movement. You know, Crenshaw recently did an interview where he called out the performance artists of the Republican Party. And he told us, we know who they are. He didn't want to name any names. He doesn't want to make any waves because he's smart. I'll give him that. He is smart. He's good at what he does. But it's pretty obvious that he is talking about your Marjorie Taylor Greens and your Lauren Boberts, and Madison Cawthorns, the people who are out there just to get famous. They just want people to know their names. And as he pointed out correctly, by the way, they're not doing anything legislatively. Okay, they're not actually furthering the conservative cause, as he says. And his ability to call these people out and seem, as he's calling them out, like the rational choice, like the best alternative, is what does make him so incredibly dangerous as a potential candidate in the future. And then, of course, you have the performative side. Crenshaw has something the rest of them don't. He's got military credentials, and as Cliff Schechter points out again, he's got the battle wound. He's got the eye patch. And I'm not saying that to attack him, but that eye patch is a constant reminder that he served, that he went over there and fought the fight that these other conservatives only push from behind their legislative desks. That makes a big difference with these Republican candidates. Somebody who can go out there and say, oh, well, you say you support the military, but I was actually in it. I fought it. And I live with the ramifications of it. He's got that tough guy persona that Donald Trump could only pretend to have. And of course, you do have the performance artist in him, right? We've all seen the videos that Crenshaw's put out, himself, you know, rappelling down from the ceilings, acting like some kind of Avenger / secret agent guy, this big tough bravado of only I can save this, which is kind of similar to what Donald Trump actually said when he first ran for president, only I can do this. And that's what Crenshaw is putting out there. He appeals to the Trumpers, but he can act sane enough. Because I do think, to his credit, I think he is a sane person. but I think he knows when to turn on the crazy and turn it off, and that's what separates him from the rest of the pack. That's what makes him different from a Marjorie Taylor Greene. It's what makes him different from a Ted Cruz, because Ted Cruz has gone full-blown into all of this. He doesn't know who he is. But Crenshaw can turn it on and turn it off like that. And as Cliff points out, that's something that makes him incredibly valuable to the conservative movement, and of course, makes him incredibly scary as a potential Republican candidate in the future. I'm Farron Cousins. Follow me on YouTube at youtube.com/TheRingOfFire and youtube.com/FarronBalanced. I'm across social media platforms, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at FarronBalanced. You're watching The David Pakman Show. We'll be right back with more. Welcome back to The David Pakman Show. I am Farron Cousins from Ring of Fire, sitting in for David Pakman. I've been sitting in for David all of this week. He will return to you on Monday. I promise he has given me his word. But let's finish things up here, shall we? And of course, as I've done every day this week, you got to talk a little bit about Joe Manchin, public enemy number one. And now we're finding out that Republicans, including Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, are actively trying to recruit Joe Manchin over to the dark side. Come to us officially, they're telling him. And that's not hyperbole either. Literally, it's been reported that John Cornyn admitted to sending Joe Manchin a text message inviting him to come and join the Republican Party in the Senate. We're your friends. You're just like us. Come on, Joe, what do you say? Mitch McConnell, however, said in an interview with the New York Times, "Obviously, we would love to have him on our team. I think he'd be more comfortable. Why in the world would they, the Democrats, want to call him a liar and try to hotbox him and embarrass him? I think the message is we don't want you around. Obviously, that is up to Joe Manchin, but he is clearly not welcome on that side of the aisle." Joe Manchin himself this week also talked about the bullying that he is receiving from those on the left for killing the Build Back Better Act. And said, you know, they ought to push me into the Republican Party. That's what he said. And I think these Republicans took that as, if they're not going to push you, we're going to try to pull you. So come on, Joe. And to be honest, think about it this way. Obviously, if Joe Manchin were to leave the Democratic Party, go over to the Republicans, they get the majority, they take over the committees and all of that. It's horrible, right? Right? Is it? The Democrats are already struggling to get anything done because they have only 50, and Republicans have 50. And Joe Manchin is the biggest roadblock. Now, I understand 100%. If Joe Manchin were to leave the Democrats, become a Republican, give them the majority, nothing gets done. You know, the Voting Rights Act, kiss that goodbye. Any chance of getting a different version of Build Back Better, gone. But what are the chances of those things happening with Joe Manchin as a Democrat anyway? Wouldn't it make more sense, electorally speaking, for the Democrats to boot Joe Manchin, don't give him the option, tell him you're out, and then let the Republicans take the fall for it? The public wants the Build Back Better Act. So if you can pin the whole thing on Republicans, if Joe Manchin were to go over there, wouldn't that be a better campaign message? You know, look, we tried to give you all these things and it got so bad that one of our guys ended up becoming a Republican because he hates it so much. He doesn't want you to have good things. So he's joining the party that continuously refuses to let you have good things because that's what they stand for, because that's who they are. So if you want these things, we got to get the majority back. Now, as again, I've talked about that this week, Republicans have to defend 20 seats. 20 seats in 2022. That requires a lot of money, and the odds significantly reduce that you're going to hold on to every single one of those seats the more you have to defend. You also have members who are considering retirement, some who've already announced retirement. So in those new races, of course, that's going to be far more expensive, and it opens the door for a Democrat challenger to seize the seat. So Democrats could probably come up with a winning message by getting rid of Joe Manchin. Because again, then the entire boogeyman becomes the Republican Party. I'm just throwing it out there as a possibility, as a very real electoral strategy that the Democratic Party should at least consider. And if you're not willing to kick Joe Manchin out, or not willing to push him over to the other side, then at the very least, don't let him get his hands on the DNC money when he's not going to support the Democratic Party itself. I mean, after all, reports have also come out this week saying that he's receiving so much corporate cash right before he announced that he was not going to be supporting the Build Back Better Act. So Joe Manchin will be fine. Hell, he's not even up for re-election for a while. So don't worry about him. Kick him out. Make him part of the enemy. And see what you can come up with in terms of electoral strategy messaging once that happens. You keep him in the party, you're going to have to deal with him and his problems and the negativity that he brings with him for at least another full year. And to me, personally, I just don't think that's worth it. There would, maybe, however, one way that it could be worth it. And that is if Joe Manchin agrees to kill the filibuster so that Democrats can pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. And the reason that piece of legislation is so dang important is because of the new report we got this week. According to a new report from CNN, you have multiple Republican-controlled states out there, including some who have already passed restrictive voting measures this year, that already have a full slate of legislation with even more restrictions heading our way in 2022. Let me read this. Lawmakers in four states already have pre-filed at least 13 bills for the 2022 legislative sessions that would make it harder to cast a ballot. That is, of course, according to the Brennan Center for Justice. In five states, six pre-filed bills would allow audits or reviews of election results as former President Donald Trump and his allies continue to baselessly attribute his 2020 loss to election fraud. In addition, some 88 restrictive bills that were introduced but failed to become law in nine states this year are expected to carry over into legislative sessions set to begin early next year. And let's not forget that so far in 2021, 19 states passed 34 restrictive voting bills. Because this is what they do. Because this is the only way that Republicans can win. They can't win on the issues. They can't win on economics. They can't win on policy. They can't win on populism. I know Trump did in 2016, but technically lost the popular vote. So what do? They do two things. They resort to culture war issues, which they've been fairly successful with this year. And of course, voter suppression. Keep just enough people out of the way, and we might be able to have a victory. Drum up even more support from our crazed base with these culture war issues by talking about critical race theory and transgender athletes, and we might be able to eke out a victory. And of course, they're helped along the way with gerrymandering, which is going to play a huge role in the 2022 elections. The only X factor out there right now is how many people died from COVID that would vote for Republicans. According to the numbers we're seeing right now, a lot. So they're going to have to contend with that. Continuing to push anti-mask and anti-vax viewpoints isn't going to work out so well for them electorally. So, of course, they have to push these restrictive voting bills. And as I said, one of the worst parts of this is some of these are in states that have already passed restrictive voting measures this year. Florida and Georgia are the top two. Georgia is still trying to go even further, according to this new report, by further limiting drop boxes, further limiting collection of ballots, and of course, cutting down on the number of polling places in a given county. Florida, again, I mentioned this earlier this week, they want to create a new $5 million office whose job it is to go around and find voter fraud, which, I mean, does exist to a small degree, certainly not in enough numbers to sway an election. And, of course, most of the cases we're finding here in Florida are Republicans, so that's probably not going to work out very well for them, but that's what they're doing. And they're doing it because they can't win on the issues. They can't win talking to normal people. So they shut them out. They get them out of the system, get them off the voting rolls by any means necessary, because that is their only path to victory. They've been hugely successful with it in the past. And most of these places where these bills are being proposed, there's not enough opposition to prevent them from becoming law before the 2022 election. And finally, for this week for me, we got to talk even more, unfortunately, about the Turning Point USA conference, because there's one last thing from that that I want to discuss that is truly terrifying, and that is Madison Cawthorn, during his speech, started talking about civil war and how if we have another civil war, which he swears he doesn't want, but if we have one, man, conservatives are totally going to win it. Here's what he says. We, patriotic Americans, because Republicans hold a monopoly on patriotism, were born for such a time as this. We're going to face some dark times as a nation. I genuinely believe that. I think we have an opportunity in the next 4 to 6 years to prevent kinetic force, countrymen on countrymen, from ever meeting. Although I have no doubt we would be victorious if that would ever happen. But remember, that would be so immoral and wrong if we said, hey, you know what, let's kick off a civil war, and then we'll just go ahead and go to that.
From New York, this is Democracy Now! Today, a special on two men who won't be home for Christmas, Julian Assange and Edward Snowden.
The most important thing about the stories of 2013 that I think people looked at is it was not a story about surveillance. It was a story about democracy. The surveillance system, the global mass surveillance system, was the product of a failure in governance, where we, the public, had sort of lost our seat at the table.
As WikiLeaks stands under threat, so does the freedom of expression and the health of all our societies.
In a special broadcast, an hour with NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden, who's in political exile in Moscow, along with journalists Glenn Greenwald and Chris Hedges, we'll talk about mass surveillance, government secrecy, internet freedom, and U.S. attempts to extradite and prosecute WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who's in prison in London.
What they're really angry about is that he represents still a weapon that prevents them from doing what is most important to them, which is the ability to run the world, including societies that are ostensibly democratic, without anyone knowing what they're doing.
All that and more coming up. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, a special on two people who will not be home for the holidays, Edward Snowden and Julian Assange. In this special broadcast, we spend the hour with NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden, along with two Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists, Glenn Greenwald and Chris Hedges. I recently moderated a discussion with them at the virtual War on Terror Film Festival after a screening of Citizen Four, the Oscar-winning documentary about Edward Snowden by Laura Poitras. The documentary chronicles how Snowden met with Laura Poitras waitress and Glenn Greenwald in a hotel room in Hong Kong in June 2013 to share a trove of secret documents about how the United States had built a massive surveillance apparatus to spy on Americans and people across the globe. It was the biggest leak ever to come out of the NSA. After sharing the documents, Edward Snowden was charged in the United States for violating the Espionage Act and other laws. As he attempted to flee from Hong Kong to Latin America, Snowden was stranded in Russia at the airport after the U.S. revoked his passport. He was granted political asylum and has lived in Moscow ever since. I began by asking Edward Snowden to talk about why he chose to blow the whistle on the NSA.
I grew up in the shadow of government. Both my parents worked for the government, and I expected that I would as well. September 11th happened when I was 18 years old, and it was one of those things that really changes the politics, not only of the people, but of place. And at the time, I didn't really question that. It just seemed like, you know, we had this new problem. Everybody on TV is saying we did it. And when everybody else was protesting the Iraq war, I was volunteering to join it. And that's because I believed the things that the government was saying. Not all of them, of course, but I believed that the government was mostly honest, because it seemed to me unreasonable that the government would be willing to risk sort of our long-term faith in the institution of government for short-term political advantage. As I said, I was a very young man. I ended up going to work for the CIA undercover overseas out of the diplomatic platforms. Then I moved into contracting, which is really, you're still working for the government in government offices, taking the directed